Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. So I'm going to begin today's show with a question, and that is this. Why would a small town called Kermit, with a population of just 382 people, need 12 million pills in 3 years? Yes, 382 people in the town of Kermit and 12 million pills passed through that town in 3 years. Well, in his new book, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eric Eyre investigates the mysteries, tragedies, and government corruption behind the opioid crisis in West Virginia. The counties where the story unfolds have the highest overdose rates in our country. It's really quite shocking. The corruption that goes on there is equally as shocking. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Eric Eyre was a reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail for more than 20 years. In 2017, his series of investigations into massive shipments of opioids to West Virginia's southern coalfields was awarded a Pulitzer Prize. It's actually quite significant because it's the smallest community newspaper ever to have won a Pulitzer Prize. It's a big deal. The book Eric wrote following that series and following receiving the Pulitzer Prize is called Death in Mud Lick, a coal country fight against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic. And I'm going to bring my guest on in just a minute. But I want to tell you what Booklist said. They called it compellingly told story, a tale of compassionate people deeply wronged and a dogged journalist who won't stand for it. I should have said that Eric is also known as a journalist who fights for the underdog. If there's an underdog anywhere, he's going to find it and fight for that underdog. And Kirkus Reviews calls the book disturbing, moving, and heart-wrenching. I personally found it quite fascinating. The book again, Death in Mud Lick, and here's my guest, Eric Eyre. Well, Eric Eyre, I want to welcome you to the show today. Very pleased to talk with you. And this is such an interesting subject, and I know it's something you're passionate about. You're a lifetime journalist. Your website says, I write about the opioid crisis, government corruption, and rural issues in Appalachia. What drove you to that career choice, Eric?
Well, I kind of stumbled into it. Back when I was in college, I was actually a broadcast journalism major in New Orleans, and I was so terrible at that. Wasn't made for the camera. I remember fumbling around trying to do the weather map with the green or the blue thing behind you, and missed different parts of the country saying there was a cold front moving through Seattle when I was pointing to Florida. So. My last semester had a professor that actually was kind enough to, it was a feature writing class, and he assigned papers for us to write for the class, and not telling me, he actually started submitting them to local magazines on a freelance basis, and a couple of them came through, and I got a check for $150, and a career was born. I was thrilled when I was in college to get a check for $150.
Right. Well, what a great teacher who did that for you, too. And so you began in Escondido. I used to work in Vista, so I'm very familiar with that area. In Southern California. That was my first job in America, in Vista. And so you then moved to, I think it was 1998, you moved out to West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette, is that correct?
Yes, Charleston Gazette, yes.
Yeah, and their mantra was sustained outrage, so that's intriguing. Tell us why you chose to work, first of all, at a smaller community paper versus a large one, and what that mantra, sustained outrage, means.
Sure. I was in graduate school in in Florida, and I actually had two job offers. One was in Arkansas at the Little Rock paper, and one was in Charleston. I didn't really want to write about, well, actually, it was kind of far away from home, too, the Little Rock paper. And we decided to come here. My mom was living in Indiana, and my wife's parents were in Pittsburgh at the time. So we came here, and when I came to interview, there was a clip up on the wall, and it said "Sustained Outrage," and it was about the late publisher Ned Chilton of the Charleston Gazette. And I, you know, asked for a copy of that, and I read it. And what it means is it talks about how the media is easily distracted from moving from story to story, and what he was telling reporters they should do was to practice sustained outrage, which means hammering away at injustices until they're righted. So staying on a story, staying on top of the story, holding public officials accountable until they actually do something.
Right, and that is something that's in rare form today, because we want to move on quickly, and I think it's important to follow up on those stories, and it's nice to hear how they turned out too. But you won the Pulitzer Prize for an investigative reporting series. You wrote a series of articles on West Virginia's opioid epidemic, which obviously led to the book we're going to talk about today, Death in Mud Lick. Tell us how you first got interested in that story, why you started writing articles on the opioid epidemic.
Well, I came on it in a different way. I was a beat reporter down at the state capitol. I was covering state government corruption. I was covering legislative meetings, legislation, just the whole gamut of story, press conferences and such. And in 2013, we had a new attorney general elected. Before he ran for office, he had never practiced law in the state. He got his law license just days before he decided to run. So it was a real unknown quantity. And he came in, his first Republican attorney general that had been elected in the state since the 1930s. And he came in, and I got a tip that this company called Cardinal Health was paying for his inaugural party. And I, you know, got some, you know, other information that Cardinal Health was one of the drug distributors, and these are companies that ship drugs from the manufacturing facility to the pharmacies and the hospitals, that they were, actually the largest distributor also of pain pills in West Virginia. So I got a tip that they were paying for the inaugural, that they had helped bankroll his campaign, and then it finally turned out that his wife, the attorney general's wife, was the lead lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for one of these companies. And this lawsuit was initiated by his predecessor, a Democratic incumbent, for 20-some years. And he had sued Cardinal Health along with some other distributors, alleging that they had what they called then the prescription drug problem, had fueled the prescription drug problem by shipping an excessive number of opioids into the state of West Virginia.
Right, and so this attorney general, he thought there was no problem with all of that, right? It's like Patrick Morrissey, he just thought this was all okay, that his wife's lobbying and everything's just going on as normal for him.
Well, he said from the get-go that he had recused himself or stepped aside from the case and assigned it to others, and that he had zero involvement from the day he was elected in office. We'd probably go into it later, but we found out later there were some documents that showed that he had been involved in the case.
Right.
And he also, I should add, that he also was a lobbyist prior to becoming West Virginia's Attorney General. He was a lobbyist for the drug trade group that represented Cardinal Health and the other distributors.
Right. So let's look at West Virginia. You describe it as a vulnerable population. You say it was as if the doctors, clinics and drugstores existed only to make the users addicts and repeat customers. It's quite horrifying when you read some of the statistics around this. So why West Virginia in particular do you think that this is so prevalent?
Yeah, it's it's you know, predominantly poor state, and the coal mining industry has taken a huge hit, despite what the president might say, continues to take a huge hit. Loss of coal jobs. There's a loss of hope in many of these communities, and there's just despair, and also it's a hard working, heavy equipment type jobs that people have. You know, you had situations where you have a lot of coal miners getting injured on the job, and they have back pain, and they needed a prescription, and one thing would lead to another, and before you know it, they were hooked.
And so in 2016, Debbie Priest enters your investigative world. Her brother died from an overdose, and you say it really all began, this journey, with what was a seemingly unremarkable death in a place called Mud Lick. So tell us how you started working on putting this together.
Right, I didn't meet Debbie till 2016, and then I got her depositions and interviewed her extensively. And she started this whole thing, that led to, you know, we have 3,000 plus lawsuits nationwide, but it really started with her in the small community of Mud Lick. She lives in Kermit, which is another small community, but her brother overdosed on OxyContin, and she vowed from, this is in 2005, and she vowed from that day forward her brother was not going to become another statistic, as she said. We had had a real increase in overdose deaths, steady climb from 2000 to actually till last year we finally had a little dip, but you know, there was upwards of 700, 800 people overdosing on prescription opioids in the state. We had the highest prescription drug overdose death rates in the nation. And she just vowed at that point her brother's death was not going to be in vain. And she started the ball rolling. She made a phone call to Jim Cagle, who was her lawyer back in the late 1980s, when she actually went to prison for a drug conspiracy, a drug ring and corruption ring in the tiny town of Kermit, West Virginia, with her parents. And he failed to keep her out of jail, but she still, you know, remembered his name, remembered who he was. And they got together, and they said, let's start holding people accountable. So they filed a wrongful death suit against the doctor who prescribed upwards of 600 prescription opioids over the course of a month to her brother, and then the pharmacy in Kermit, which was filling illegal prescriptions, some say one every minute, for at least 2 years.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned the town, Kermit. It's just a small town, just 382 people, you say. In 2 years, out-of-state drug companies shipped nearly 9 million opioid pain pills to Kermit. That's a heck of a lot for 382 people, assuming everybody's taking them. But they weren't, in fact, because let's talk about the central point of sale, if you will, for these drugs, which is Save Right Pharmacy. You can't make this stuff up, Eric. If you put this in a novel, people would say, this is unrealistic. But you say people would literally travel hundreds of miles from places like Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, Tennessee. The queues were so long at this Save Right Pharmacy that they served popcorn and hot dogs to keep people entertained while they're waiting in line. Talk to us a little bit about that and how they got away with it for so long. It seems inconceivable.
Well, everybody knew what was going on, but to be honest, the local authorities weren't going to do anything. Their brothers, their sisters, their parents were working in these pharmacies. I mean, that was one of the biggest businesses in town, and the pharmacies also, not just this one, but others, you know, they'd sponsor the local Little League team. So they'd give campaign contributions to the mayor and the city council. But, yeah, as you describe it, you know, people were coming from all over the place. They were bringing these illegal prescriptions from what were called pain management clinics. They had crazy names like the Wellness Center, but they were just places where you'd go in, say, my back hurts, you pay $150 and you get a actually had a different colored bag for opioids. Came in a white bag, and regular prescriptions came in a brown bag. So people that were leaving the parking lot who had legitimate, you know, blood pressure medications or something they had to pick up, that they wouldn't get robbed. Vicki, to explain, these pharmacies, they're not like the size of a Rite Aid or Walgreens. They are literally shoe boxes. I mean, like a quarter of the size, an eighth of a size, maybe of a fast food restaurant. But they've got a heck of a drive through and a heck of a system for churning out opioids.
Right. I read too that the owner of that Save Right pharmacy used to sell used cars in the parking lot. I mean, it seems like something that's surreal, but obviously very true. So obviously, to keep pace with demand, he needed suppliers, and this is where the distributors come in. And you know, I've always pointed the finger at pharmaceutical companies for the misuse of prescription drugs, and because they do push it. I never even thought about distributors, but they're a major key player in this book, in your story, and in the lives of these people who are getting addicted. So tell us a little bit about McKesson Corporation. You say ranked sixth in the Fortune 500 company, and a couple of years back, the CEO was the highest paid corporate executive in the land.
Yeah, these are the biggest companies that nobody's really ever heard of, or maybe they've heard of them now because they're all being sued. But, back in that time, I had never heard of McKesson. I had never heard of Cardinal Health. I had never heard of AmerisourceBergen. There's a regional distributor named Miami Lucan, too, which is bankrupt now. But these were enormous companies. I mean, we all know, when we say Apple, when we say Walmart, we say Exxon, Berkshire Hathaway, we all, know that they're tops in the Fortune 500.
Right.
But then we get to McKesson is like number six, and you're like, who the heck is that? And then Cardinal Health, I mean, these shipped around, but they are all in the top 15. You have Cardinal Health and AmerisourceBergen, and I just never had heard of them. And frankly, when I was so kind of in the weeds in the reporting on this, I didn't even realize that they were so big till late in the game. When we went to, I don't mean to skip ahead too much, but when we went to court to try to unearth some of these bill numbers, we walked in and it was a little rural courthouse, something like right out of what you'd picture in The To Kill a Mockingbird, creaky floors, hooks on the wall to hang your coat, echoes, from the emptiness of this giant courtroom. But all of a sudden, we walked in and there was like 30 to 40 corporate lawyers there, and they were saying they had just flown in from Washington, D.C., from New York, and they were from some of the biggest law firms in the country. And it kind of clicked with me at that point. And I walked in with one lawyer who was a law professor who was working for free for us from West Virginia University. And here we are, one against 30 lawyers. And then I said, man, these stakes are high. And this is why they're fighting us to keep these numbers a secret and shield them from the public.
Yeah, and that's why we've never heard of them very much either, right? They don't want to advertise who they are. Very difficult, I would imagine, trying to communicate with those people.
Yeah, I mean, everything was through corporate spokespeople, and they kind of didn't take me seriously at the beginning. They kind of just kind of shunted me aside. Even when we wrote the big stories back in late 2016, when we first got these numbers, Cardinal Health sent a team of compliance directors down to meet with me. AmerisourceBergen did the same thing, and they kind of, would say, "Well, we're doing the right things today, and we're doing this and that, and we have this real good compliance program." And I was like, "Well, what did you do prior to 2016? And what about all these big numbers. And they said, well, we weren't really looking at those kind of numbers. We were just looking at individual orders from pharmacies. But they were violating all sorts of rules. There were rules that you had to report suspicious, they call them suspicious orders, which is a order that's of unusual size or frequency. They had thresholds that they were supposed to do, and they weren't reporting. They were exceeding their thresholds, not by you know, 1,000 pills. They're exceeding their thresholds by 30 times the amount. So if their threshold was like 6,000 OxyContin pills per month, they were actually shipping like 180,000 OxyContin pills per month.
Mm. I read that the big three, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, literally have a stranglehold. They control 85% of drug shipments. And this just this shocked me, and I've done several shows on addiction. Americans were consuming more than 80% of the world's supply of oxycodone and 99% of its hydrocodone. Shocking.
Yeah, it's just the, you know, almost the insatiable appetite of us for prescription drugs. And, you know, it all started, of course, everybody knows the story of the Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family and how they marketed OxyContin as a drug that wasn't addictive. Well, of course, we know it's probably the most addictive drug in the history of the planet. And, you know, it just was a total, everybody was deceived. You know, you even had really, you know, doctors wanting to do the right thing, but they were pressured into prescribing, especially in the emergency room. I've got friends that work at the emergency room and said there was a lot of pressure to, you know, somebody came in and had a toothache in the emergency room and, you know, give them a 60-day supply or a 90-day supply of OxyContin and send them on their way. So it was, they also had convinced the boards of medicine that these were safe drugs. So just a systematic up and down the chain. It was almost one of the characters in the book. I just talked to him yesterday. He called to say he really enjoyed the book. He described it as like a cartel, almost a legal cartel.
Yeah.
They had these doctors working with the pharmacists, working with the distributors, working with the manufacturers, and everybody now they want to blame. Everybody wants to blame everybody but themselves.
Yes, you spoke with Don Perdue, a pharmacist, state legislator, for his reaction at one point, and he said that the vast amounts of narcotics flooding into the small towns and rural areas of our state should have set off more flags, red flags, than a school of sharks at a crowded beach, but it didn't. So why are regulatory agencies not paying attention? I read that there are only two for the whole state, two DEA agents.
That's true. I mean, at the height of this flooding of complete saturation of pills and pills pouring into small town pharmacies, not just in Appalachia but across the country. In West Virginia, we had just two DEA Drug Enforcement Administration agents, just two for the entire state. For prescription drug diversion. Now they have like 15 to 20. They've corrected that, but there was a serious shortage of manpower. And like I said earlier, the local authorities weren't going to do anything because they were, you know, they had ties to these pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to look the other way. And then at one point, and I don't know why, but never found out why, but one of the DEA agents committed suicide. And then they only had one who was responsible for the entire state of West Virginia, based here in Charleston. It was just incredible, the amount, the lack of oversight, lack of manpower.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. So these people are all getting fat and rich and happy. Let's look at the human cost, the other side of things, the people who are becoming addicted because of all this laxness. I don't know how many people you talked to, but I'm imagining it was quite a number.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the economic costs are in the hundreds of millions every year. We're still, you know, devastated. We're going to live with this for generations. You know, you have the highest rate of babies born dependent on drugs or knows somebody that's died of an overdose, somebody who's struggled with the problem. And there are you know, success stories, of course, which are wonderful to hear. But you have this generation too of parents who are addicted, who have given up on their children, and now are being raised by their grandparents. We have the highest rate of foster care children on a per capita basis in the country. So it's just in so many ways, the courtrooms are filled up with people with addiction. We were seeing some positive momentum of trying to, you know, for the first time in like I said, in a decade, the drug overdose has declined slightly, in large part because we have Narcan and Naloxone readily available, and those are overdose reversing drugs, and just about everybody here carries it or knows somebody that has it. All the businesses have it, so they've done a good job of that. I do have concerns with, you know, coronavirus and the isolation people are experiencing, that this could turn back in the wrong direction, but it's something that's going to take a long time. To people think, you know, oh, you know, you can fix this in 30 days. No, it takes a good, talk to anybody who's been successful through recovery, it takes a good 3 to 5 years before they're fully drug free.
Yeah, I think people who have not ever been on drugs don't understand that, because, to be honest, I never understood drug addiction. I was like, okay, well, just give it up, you know. Yeah, not that easy. I watched some of those shows they had on a while back called Intervention, and it's brutal. It is brutal watching people not just coming out of addiction, but while they're still addicted, their behaviors and how it disrupts and rips apart families. But let's look at some of the success stories. Do you have a favorite success story?
Oh, I mean, there's success stories everywhere. I mean, we have our the administrator, office administrator of our church has been helping me promote my book, and she's 5 years drug-free just last Friday, celebrating that, turned her life around. In the book, we talked to Chelsea Carter, who was hopelessly addicted back when she was in her early 20s. She's in her early 30s now, and she went to jail. Her father was the mayor of this small town in West Virginia where all these court battles had played out. And Chelsea Carter is her name. She went on, after she got out of jail, she was able to get drug free, and then she became a counselor, and she actually has traveled across the country telling her story. She was invited when Hillary Clinton campaigned in West Virginia. She was invited on stage with Hillary Clinton, and now she's actually one of the top directors of the first ever drug treatment program, medication-assisted treatment program, in this county of Boone County that was once almost one of the epicenters of the drug crisis, and she's now counseling and helping other people in recovery. So there's plenty of success stories.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I want to talk a little bit about journalism, because it's taken a huge hit over the last few years. I've always said we need great newspaper reporters, because they're often the ones who expose the biggest corruptions. If you look back in history, it's nearly all newspaper, you know, hardcore newspaper reporters who've broken those corruptions and scandals. And you know, as a lifetime journalist, as a Pulitzer Prize winner for investigative journalism, what do you want to say about the importance of journalism?
Well, to be honest, I wrote the book as sort of a siren call for sustaining local watchdog journalism. You know, now in this age of coronavirus, everybody knows that newspapers have been slashing costs, the advertising has collapsed. There's mass layoffs, there's furloughs. I myself resigned 2 weeks ago. We were going through a series of layoffs, and I got a call, and it's actually the day my book was released, publication date, publishing day, and I got a call from the new executive editor, and he wanted to meet with me and the comptroller. And the comptroller, for those who don't know, or is the person who handles the purse strings, and right now at our newspaper, those purse strings are tighter than a fiddle's, and I kind of saw the writing on the wall, so I wanted to get ahead of it, and I turned in my resignation instead of going in. I also didn't want to go into the newsroom. I, for safety reasons, I wanted to stay clear of the newsroom. So, I resigned 2 weeks ago after 22 years at the paper. You know, I was hoping maybe I could stave off, you know, another younger reporter from losing their job, although they had another round of layoffs this week. This is going on everywhere across the country. The Los Angeles Times, all of its community papers, just yesterday they laid off a whole load of reporters. They closed down the community papers. The Cleveland Plain Dealer laid off 40 reporters about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. So this is a really, really tough time for local newspapers. My hope is that they'll be replaced. And again, this is at a time where reporters are out busting their butts doing incredible work on the coronavirus outbreak, you know, telling the stories, holding public officials accountable, serving as watchdogs for the public. But my hope is that there's this new model for what they call nonprofit news outlets. There's one starting up here in June. I'm interested to see how that works out, but they're based on money from foundations, and I think that's going to be probably the savior of local journalism, because it's definitely worth saving. We see that now more than ever.
We do indeed. I despair sometimes at some of the things that are said about journalism. Of course, you have some not so great journalists. You do in every profession, but I seriously believe every person who goes into journalism, it's not that well paid. The hours can be brutal. I mean, let me just check this. I read that you were writing 250 stories a year. With threats of losing your job because of what was going on with, you know, the community, and yet you still managed to turn these stories out and write this book. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm no Woodward and Bernstein. I'm no big investigative reporter. We didn't have an I team. Like, we didn't have a year or two to work on a story. We, you know, in the trenches in these small towns, like small papers like I work at, you have to cover, you know, city council. You have to cover the school board meetings. I did that for years. I covered the health board meetings. I covered business meetings, the press conferences, just the whole gamut. I worked before the Pulitzer, and after the Pulitzer, I was working. I had to work the night cop shift, where you sit and listen to the scanner, and then, you know, go chase whatever the police are working on that night. And I had to do that for 20 plus years, on usually sometimes every Friday night, and then once a month on a Friday night. So it's a big different world than what people see, you know, the reporters on CNN and
right,
and that sort of thing. We're really, really in the trenches. Kind of got our heads down, and we're just in just the mode of, you know, and we had, you know, you have to, if it's a small paper, you have to fill the paper, you have to churn out copies, so there's a constant demand for copy. And, you know, I hit a lot of singles in my career, and then by happenstance, I happened to hit on a big story at the right time.
but the key thing is here, Eric, you did something with it. You won a flipping Pulitzer Prize, for goodness sake. I think you're being very modest there.
I mean, and that in itself was a shock, and it's a real experience, and still hasn't sunk in.
I saw the clip on your website where the, I don't know if it was your editor, and he was putting the headline to announce in the newspaper that the, you know, the newspaper and reporter had won the Pulitzer Prize, and you said, no, take my name off. Take my name off the headline.
Oh, it was shocking to see my name in a headline. Right. Nobody wants their name in a headline, right? Maybe you didn't have a headline, but it just looked really awkward, and I, you know, it was the, you know, everybody, the paper, it was the paper's win, something to rally around. 8 months after that, we declared bankruptcy. But to going back to that day, just to show you how unprepared you were, I thought when people win Pulitzer Prizes, you know, you see these pictures in the Washington Post and the New York Times newsroom, they're everybody sitting around the computer, and then they cheer, and then the champagne starts flowing. and well, this is such a shock to me. I was actually outside in the parking garage, and then I was walking in. I had no clue that we had won. We had no champagne. We had our actually 80-year-old owner, Betty Chilton, bless her heart. Her daughter, who was the publisher at the time, was out of town and on vacation. So she stopped at the Rite Aid on the way into the, you know, she was at home when this happened, and we had no champagne, so she stopped at the Rite Aid and bought a bottle of Korbel, which I'm not a champagne aficionado, but Korbel is in Dom Perignon. So,
I love it.
You can see from that video, I was in total shock and just sort of collapsed into the editor's arms. And still to this day, it's still hard to believe. It really hasn't sunk in yet.
But this is why, to anyone listening, we need to support newspapers in general, and especially community newspapers, because they depend on the community. So and your book, I hope, is going to go and do great things, because of course it's well written and well researched. And I have just a quick question. You talked about, you know, how, what you hope will happen, and you are concerned that, you know, the people of West Virginia will be forgotten. During the 2016 campaign, we heard Donald Trump incessantly talk about he was going to crush the opioid crisis. What has that administration done, and are they having an effect?
Well, he sends the first lady here and has her hold babies in the NICU unit of drug dependent babies, and that's about it. They really haven't done much of anything. He makes promises that he's going to do something, but the people, the state officials here have taken it seriously. The legislature has passed massive restrictions on opioid painkillers, so that they limit your supply to seven day supply. There's more accountability, there's more reporting, there's more tracking of opioids. Of course, the problem shifted to heroin, and now we've got a dual issue of heroin and meth overdoses, so it's been pushed to the street corner. But the positive thing is that, again, we seem to be turning a corner for the first time in a decade. The overdose death rate was actually declined a little bit. I think it went down about 7%, still highest in the nation, but some cause, not for celebration, but that, you know, we were starting to head in the right direction and do the right thing.
Right. Well, Eric Eyre, such a pleasure talking with you. The book is Death in Mud Lick, A Coal Country Fight Against the Drug Companies That Delivered the Opioid Epidemic. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today. I know listeners can find out much more about you at ericeyrebook.com. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I guess the takeaway is, I think, as you said earlier, I mean, you can do big things in small places. You don't have to be in New York and Washington, D.C. to do important things. You know, the presses, and the presses out there really trying to do their jobs. overcoming monumental odds, and a story of resiliency, a story of redemption, and for, you know, to say is actually, in one case, it's a story about underdogs winning, and that doesn't happen all the time.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you having me.
You can find out much more about Eric Eyre and his work at ericeyrebook.com. Eric is spelt with a C and Eyre is spelt E-Y-R-E, ericeyrebook.com. And the book again is called Death in Mud Lick, A Coal Country Fight Against the Drug Companies That Delivered the Opioid Epidemic. I really do think this is an important piece of work. It is shocking on so many levels. And at the end of it, you have, you know, people whose lives are being destroyed. All right, well, that brings us to the end of today's show. I want to thank you for being with us today. I hope you're not going too stir crazy with staying at home in quarantine because of COVID-19. Hopefully we see the light at the end of the tunnel pretty soon, but meanwhile, please stay safe. And if you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me at conversationslive.net. We post a new podcast every Wednesday. And you'll find a whole bunch, you know, more than 700 podcasts, more than 1,200 guest interviews up there. So we always love to hear from you. And I want you to have a great week this week. Stay safe, be happy, and stay strong. We'll see you next week.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversations.live.net. That's conversationslive.net today.